You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
I don't know if you've ever had an opportunity to go somewhere that is like normally off limits to you. Like maybe you've gone to a concert, your favorite band, and after the show you got to go backstage. And to do so, you had to have someone, know someone who had access who could go back with you, because you can't just wander around backstage by yourself. Or maybe you've been one of the rare people who's gotten to tour the West Wing of the White House. They don't do tours for just the general public in the West Wing. That's the East Wing. But if you had a connection, a White House staffer or someone with access, maybe you got a tour. And I'm told that even with your access and your security clearance, you can't actually go into the Oval Office, right? You can only look in there. I have a friend who sometimes invites me. His name is Clifton. Some of you know him. Sometimes he invites me to sit in a box suite over at a UT football game. And that's not a regular occurrence for me, but sometimes Clifton invites me. And on those Saturdays, I go to the stadium, and I go up to the will call window, and I pick up my special tickets that Clifton has left behind in an envelope for me. These are the nicest tickets you have ever seen. You would want to frame them. I think they're like oil painted on canvas. I get my tickets. I walk past all the other common people who are waiting in line to get into the stadium, and I get onto a private elevator. And a gentleman in uniform presses the button for me, because I can't be doing that, right? Now, mind you, I'm only on the elevator because Clifton invited me. I go up to the suite, and when I get to the suite, Clifton greets me with a hug and a handshake, and he invites me to, and he introduces me to some of his friends and his family. Now, at halftime, I am aware that the masses down below are in the concession lines paying $5 for a bottle of water. But I'm on my third beverage already. I'm going back through the buffet line that Clifton's family has paid for so that I can enjoy it. And sometimes I wander over to the window and I just kind of look down on the proletariat down there, and just to kind of see, you know, what life is like down there. And I kind of feel sorry for those people. Now, mind you, I'm only there because of Clifton, right? Clifton invited me. He ushered me in. He made my game day experience possible. Next week, I will be back in front of the TV to watch the game. There are some places that you can only go if someone is with you, right? Someone who has access. One of those places in the universe is the throne room of God. Right? We see that in this text today, the very presence of God. Did you know that there has never, ever, ever been such a thing as unmediated access to God? We don't tend to think of God that way, do we? We tend to think, well, I'll just approach God on my own terms, however I want. It's just me and God, which is very American of us. But you can't. You can't approach God on your own terms. You need a mediator. You need someone to usher you in on God's terms. We have, during the season of Lent, we've been looking at the book of Hebrews, and we've been talking about this whole idea of drawing near to God. Well, how do you do it? How do you draw near to God? And the answer that Hebrews gives us is, you need a priest. If you're going to draw near to God, you need a priest. And you might be resistant to that. We've all come up in a culture the whole idea of a priest between us and God is kind of a foreign concept, because we live in a culture that is spiritual, not religious. Right? We live in a culture that wants to come to God in my own way. And so this whole idea of a priest could be foreign to us, but it wasn't foreign to the Hebrews. Right? It wasn't foreign to those who had come to faith in Christ out of a Jewish background. They understood the role of a priest in bringing them to God, giving them access to God. They understood the role of the high priest. But what the writer of Hebrews wants to do today is say to them and to us, hey, listen, Jesus is a better high priest. Therefore, he gives you better access to God. See, the people that this letter is being written to, the Hebrews, they were facing tremendous hard times. Persecution for their new faith in Christ. And they were thinking, you know what? It'd be easier just to go back to the old way, to Judaism. Because we had a high priest back then who gave us access to God. So why don't we just go back to them and we don't have to have all the persecution? And the writer of Hebrews wants to say, no, don't do that. Don't do that. Jesus is a better high priest. He gives you better access to God. Hold fast to your faith in him, your confession of faith in him. Better priest, better access. So here's what I want us to do. I want us to consider a few things that were true of a high priest as the Hebrews understood a high priest. And then I want to show you how Jesus is better than those things. All right? Here's the first thing about a high priest. A high priest is called. A high priest is called. Look at chapter 5, Hebrews chapter 5. Hebrews chapter 5, verse 1. It says, for every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God. And then skip down to verse 4. And no one takes this honor for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was. Now, Israel could trace their long line of high priests all the way back to Aaron. Remember, Aaron was Moses' brother. Moses, God used Moses to lead Israel out of slavery. And then shortly after that, in Exodus chapter 28, this is what God says to Moses. He says, Moses, bring your brother Aaron near and bring his sons with him from among the people of Israel so that they can serve me as priests. And so Aaron and his sons are going to serve as priests. So Aaron was the first priest, right? But he was called to that. God called him into that. He didn't just decide, I'm going to be high priest. This is not something you set out to do. Like when you're a little kid, you're like, you know what? Someday when I grow up, I'm going to be high priest. And your mom's like, yes, you're right, little Aaron. You do that. You can be anything you want to be. You can be an astronaut. You can be like LeBron James. You can be the high priest. No, you can't. You can't just choose to be the high priest. It is not some sort of self-actualizing decision where you come into your full potential as a priest. Aaron was called to be the high priest. It wasn't his decision. It also wasn't the decision of the people. Right? Did you notice that in verse 1, it says that the high priest was chosen from among the people, but he wasn't chosen by the people. Like, it wasn't a democratic election. The people weren't like, that is the best guy. He preaches the best sermons. He makes the best sacrifices. Let's make him high priest. He wasn't elected. He was appointed. And it says in verse 4 that he was appointed, he was called by God. Don't skip past that too quickly when you're reading this text. He was called by God. That's so important that the whole idea of a high priest was God's idea. Why is that so important to us? Because that means that God wants us to draw near. He wants us to have access. He wants us to come close. He wants us to know him. He doesn't want to shut us out. He appointed a high priest. The very office of high priest is a God-ordained sign of his grace, isn't it? That he wants us to draw near. Old Testament high priests were called by God. And Jesus is called in the same way. Look at verse 5. Hebrews 5:5. So also Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but was appointed. Well, who appointed him? He was appointed by him who said to him, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. And he says also in another place, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So Jesus is like Aaron in some ways. Aaron didn't appoint himself, neither did Jesus. Aaron didn't seek to glorify himself or exalt himself, neither did Jesus. So both Aaron and Jesus are called by God. They're appointed by God to be high priest. But Jesus has a better calling. Right? The text tells us that Jesus has a better calling. Look at it. First of all, God says in verse 5, he says to Jesus, Jesus, you are my son. I've begotten you. That means you are one of a kind. You are unique. See, all the other high priests were Aaron's sons, and then his grandsons, and then his great-grandsons, and so on. But God says to Jesus, you're my son. So the calling of Jesus to be high priest was a calling within the Trinity. It's an intra-Trinitarian calling. It's amazing. God, the Father appoints the Son to be our high priest. It's a better calling. Secondly, God says in verse 6, God says to Jesus, I've appointed you as a priest forever. In other words, your priesthood goes on and on. Your office doesn't come to an end. It's a perpetual priesthood. Right? Aaron's office is temporary. Your calling is forever as high priest. And then lastly, Jesus is called to be a different kind of high priest than all the other high priests. It's really significant. Look at verse 5 and 6 again. It's really significant that the author of Hebrews quotes two psalms here. He quotes from Psalm 2 and Psalm 110. The Psalm 2 quote is in verse 5. The Psalm 110 quote is in verse 6. These are what we call royal psalms. They point to the eternal kingship of Jesus, not necessarily to his priesthood. They're all about how the Messiah will be king forever, not necessarily priest. However, there's one little verse in Psalm 110 that says this, and it's quoted here in verse 6. It says, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And I read that, and I'm like, who the heck is Melchizedek? What are we talking about here? And we're going to talk about Melchizedek in more detail next week. But suffice it to say that Melchizedek is this mysterious character. He shows up just very briefly in Genesis chapter 14, and then he disappears. And you never hear about him again until Psalm 110, when we have this quote. Genesis 14 says Melchizedek was both a priest and a king. He wasn't just one, he was both, priest and king. And now in Hebrews, the author is saying, Jesus is called to be a priest like Melchizedek. In other words, he's a priest-king. He's a king-priest. That's really important. That has huge implications for us. Here's the implication. Jesus is not only our mediator, our access, he's our king, right? So when you go on a tour of the throne room of God, you look up and you realize that your tour guide is the king himself. Like the one who gives you access to the throne room is the king. It's amazing. What that means is that our priest who washes us clean from the penalty of sin so that we can approach God is actually our king who says, hey, come follow me and I will help you have power over sin so that you can not only approach God, but so that you can walk with God for the rest of your life. See, he doesn't just have priestly power to get you all cleaned up and presentable. He has kingly power to transform you, to lead you into a new way of life. He is called as the priest king. Every high priest was called. Jesus has a better calling, doesn't he? But there's something else about a high priest. He's not only called, he's also compassionate. He's compassionate. When I say that, I mean he understands what it means to be human. Like he gets it. Look at the Old Testament high priest. Look at, again at verse chapter 5, verse 1. Look at the compassion of a high priest. Verse 1, for every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God. All right, so if you're going to act on behalf of humans, it follows that you must yourself be a human. Right? The high priest was a representative human being. He was going to stand in the place of all the other human beings in his community. That was his calling, was to be a representative. We understand, so he has to be a human. We understand that. We understand how representation works. We would not elect someone from New Jersey to represent Texas, right, in Congress. Why? Because we need someone who understands Texas, right? We're not putting somebody in there who's never had a fajita before, right? We're not putting someone in there who hasn't driven on the awful nightmare of I-35 and can understand what it means to be a Texan. We want representatives who understand our needs. So the high priest must be a human being to represent humans. This makes it possible for him to be compassionate towards other human beings. Look at verse 2. Hebrews 5:2. He can deal gently with the ignorant and the wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. The high priest is gentle with those who are struggling with weakness because he's weak too. Don't you want that in your spiritual leaders? Someone who says, I get it, I understand, I know what you're feeling. Don't you want your pastor or your priest to understand and be able to identify with your weakness and be compassionate towards you in that? I mean, I do. Here's the problem for the Old Testament priest. The Old Testament priest had his compassion was limited toward others because he had his own sin to worry about. Look at verse 3 in chapter 5. Because of this, in other words, because of his weakness, he is obligated to offer sacrifice for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people. And so the priest is thinking, well, before I go in and represent the people before God, what am I going to do with my own sin? Aaron, the first high priest, is a really good example. It's a vivid example of the weakness and the sinfulness of the high priest. Do you remember what happened in Exodus chapter 32? Remember Moses was up on Mount Sinai to get the law from God, but he ended up being gone a really long time, and the people got antsy. And they're like, Aaron, hey, we don't know where Moses is. We don't know if he's coming back, but listen, we're headed off to the promised land, and we need some gods to lead us. Aaron, you're the high priest. Make us some gods. And Aaron, in this moment of stellar spiritual leadership, says, you know what? That sounds like a great idea. I'm going to make y'all some gods. And he takes their jewelry. He has everybody give their gold jewelry, and he melts it down, and he makes a golden calf. And then the people begin to bow down to the calf and worship the calf. And they say about the calf, Israel, behold, this is your God. This is your God who brought you out of Egypt. And Aaron does not correct them. He wants their approval. He's cowardly in the moment. He doesn't correct them. He doesn't say, no, guys, that's not really God. That's not God. Y'all are doing the wrong thing. He doesn't correct them. He lets the people trade in the one true God, right, for a statue of a cow. It's the worst form of idolatry. Not that we know anything about worshiping cows around here, right? Moses comes down from the mountain, and he's like, dude, Aaron, why have you led these people into such great sin? And you know what Aaron says? You know these people. They're so prone to evil. Can't control these people. He's called to represent the people, and instead he just throws them under the bus, blames them. And then he says, well, Moses, I took their jewelry, and I threw it in the fire, and out popped this golden calf. So he's lying now, and he's heaping sin upon sin upon sin. Aaron is called to represent the people, but he's kind of a yahoo, right? Not always. He's actually a pretty good high priest, but in this instance, he's really struggling. This is not his best moment. Aaron is compassionate toward the waywardness and the weakness of human beings, but we need better compassion than that, don't we? Like, we need better representation than that, I think. And the good news is that we have it. We have a better high priest. Look at chapter 4, verse 14. Chapter 4, verse 14. It says, since then, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession. This is the first time in the book of Hebrews that the author calls Jesus by name. Isn't that interesting? He's been talking about Jesus, but this is the first time he calls him by name. It's like he wants us to not miss the fact that Jesus, our high priest, is a human being, just like us. Right? He's got all these lofty titles. He's the great high priest. He's gone through the heavens. He's the Son of God. But he has a name. His name is Jesus, and he's from a little town, a little nondescript town called Nazareth. I want you to know how unimpressive and how common that name was to the average Israelite. Jesus of Nazareth. It'd be like if you asked me, hey, who's your high priest? And I'm like, his name is Bill from Lubbock. You heard of him? No. That's him, though. The author wants us to know that our high priest has a name. He's a real human being, and he's from a real place. Therefore, he can have real compassion on real human beings, like me and you. He's full of compassion. Look at verse 15, Hebrews 4, verse 15. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. So Jesus sympathizes with our weaknesses. He can identify with our struggles. He gets what it feels like to be tempted. Now, you may hear that and you may think, no, he doesn't. No, he's Jesus. He's been tempted a lot, I know, but he never sinned. He doesn't really know what it feels like. Like, he can't really sympathize with my experience with temptation. I want you to look at it a little differently. Listen to what F.F. Bruce says. I love this quote. F.F. Bruce says, only the sinless one can know temptation in its full intensity. He who falls early yields before the last strain. Isn't that great? In other words, Jesus understands the weight of temptation because he stuck it out to the very end. He never gave in to it. He understands the full force of the pull of temptation to sin because he never gave in to it. Whereas we maybe gave in after a few minutes. We're like, I give in again. Jesus never gave in. He understands how heavy and pressing down temptation can feel. He gets it. He understands what it means to be human. He understands the frailty of our humanness, the desperation of our humanness. Look at verse 7 and 8 in chapter 5. It's amazing. Hebrews 5, verse 7 says, in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him. He understood pain and grief and frailty and suffering and temptation. He's crying out to God with tears to him who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. And although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. What did Jesus do when he experienced the strong pull of temptation to reject the Father's will and to go his own way? He prayed. He cried out desperately in dependence upon the Father. You know what he was doing other than praying at that moment? I think he was showing us how to be human. See, to be fully human is to be fully dependent on God the Father. And Jesus was that in the moment of desperation. What did Jesus do when he was suffering, when it would have been easier to go a different path, when it would have been easier to choose sin because sin is more fun? He obeyed. He obeyed the Father through the suffering. I think Jesus was showing us how to be human, because to be fully human is to fully be obedient to God. And Jesus showed us that. Jesus is compassionate as a high priest, but it's a compassion that helps. He doesn't just say to us, oh, you know, I know, that stinks, man, about temptation. Oh. He gets into our situation and he shows us the way out. Hebrews 2:18, beautiful verse. Because Jesus himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. That is the kind of compassion we need. We don't just need sympathy from our high priest. We need him to pull us out. We don't need a high priest who's just wallowing around in the mud with us. We need one who understands the mud but can pull us out of the mud. Every high priest is compassionate, but Jesus has better compassion because it's a compassion that helps, right? A high priest is called, a high priest is compassionate, and lastly, let me say this, a high priest gives us access to God. He gives us access. And the way he does it is he mediates the God-appointed means for access. Look again at chapter 5, verse 1. We've been spending a lot of time in this one verse. Hebrews 5:1. For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God. Well, how does he do that? Well, it says he offers gifts and sacrifices for sins. There was one day every year that was the most holy day of the year. It was the number one holiday. It was the number one holy day for Israel. It was the Day of Atonement. They called it the day. And this was the day when the high priest would atone for the sins of the people. And on that day, this was the only day of the year, the high priest could go into the most holy place, which was the inner part of the sanctuary, as essentially the throne room of God. And only the high priest could go in there. Now, in Leviticus chapter 16, God told Moses, "Hey, Moses, tell your brother Aaron, don't be wandering in here whenever you want to, because you will die if you do. Like, you can't waltz into my throne room, into the Holy of Holies, on your own terms. You got to come in on my terms." And if you want to see God's terms for the Day of Atonement, you can read about them in Leviticus chapter 16. On the Day of Atonement, the high priest would slaughter a bull, and he would take some of the blood of the bull into the Holy of Holies, and he would sprinkle some of the blood of the bull onto the mercy seat, which was the lid of the Ark of the Covenant. And that was to atone for his own sin, to cover his own sin. And then he would go back out, and he would slaughter a goat, and he would take some of the blood of that goat, and he would bring that back in, and he would slaughter the blood, or sprinkle some of the blood of the goat on the mercy seat, the lid of the Ark of the Covenant. And that was to atone for the people's sin. There were very meticulous rules on how to do this. There was a very elaborate protocol. And Aaron and the high priest would follow that protocol to the T, because you don't want to make mistakes, because your life is at stake here. That was the Day of Atonement. Now, here's what I want you to see about that access to God's throne room under the Old Testament system. It was temporary, and it was tentative. Right? The reason it was temporary is because it only happened once a year, and Aaron, the high priest, didn't stay in there very long. Why would you? Didn't stay in there long at all. It was tentative because there was concern about, well, will the sacrifice be accepted that the high priest makes? Will it be sufficient? Because we're just talking about the blood of a bull and the blood of a goat. Did he choose the right bull? Did he choose the right goat? Will this be accepted? Will he do it right? Because he's full of flaws himself, the high priest. He's full of sin. And so the people would fast on this day, because they anxiously awaited the outcome. It was tentative, though. Now, what would give a more confident access to God's presence than that? Well, you would need a perfectly reliable high priest, and you would need a perfectly sufficient atoning blood sacrifice, wouldn't you? Isn't that the good news of the gospel, that that's what we have in Jesus? We have the perfect high priest, Jesus, the Son of God, who's gone through the heavens, and we have the perfectly sufficient blood sacrifice. Jesus brings his own blood and sprinkles it on the altar on our behalf. The blood of the eternal Lamb of God shed for us. When Jesus died on the cross, that was our Day of Atonement. It was one sacrifice for all sins for all time. Jesus is a better high priest because he brings better blood, and that gives us better access to God. And so our application for all that we've said today is found in verse 16 of chapter 4. Let me read it. Hebrews 4, 16. In light of all this, let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace. Some translations say, let us draw with boldness near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Isn't it wonderful that the throne of God is a throne of grace to those who are in Christ? It's not a throne of condemnation. It's not a throne of judgment. It's a throne of grace, and we can draw near with confidence. Now listen, confidence is not the same as arrogance. We don't arrogantly approach the throne of God on our own terms or based on our own merit. We approach it confidently based on the reliability of our high priest. He ushers us in. We can't be there without him, right? There was a movie years ago called Anna and the King. I don't know if you saw this. It was based on a novel, Anna and the King of Siam. There's a musical called The King and I. It's all the same story. But in the movie, Anna is played by Jodie Foster. And Anna is a teacher an English teacher who comes to the country of Siam, which is now called Thailand, and it's the 1860s, I think. And she comes there because she's going to teach the king's children English, and the king of Siam. And the first time she was going to meet the king, this advisor is telling her all the protocol that she needs to know before she can go in to meet the king. And he's like, you got to bow down. Your head needs to be like touching the ground. And don't speak to the king before he speaks to you. And she's like, okay. Well, she comes into the back of this throne room. It's a room about this size. And she comes in the back of the room back there, and the king is up here on his throne. And the room is full, like this room, and everybody is on their knees with their head touching the ground, except for these dignitaries right up front that he's having this meeting with. He finishes the meeting, and he decides, you know what, I'm done for the day. I'm not going to meet with anybody else. And so they tell her in the back of the room, they tell Anna, hey, you have to see the king tomorrow. He's not meeting with anybody else today. Well, she's really upset by this because she's been waiting to meet the king. And so she starts running down the aisle toward the king, ignoring all protocol. Right? And she gets about 10 yards from the king, and the guards draw their swords, and they're ready to kill her on the spot. They're going to lop her head off right there. It would have been the shortest movie ever at that point. The king intercedes and doesn't let them kill her. Anna approached the throne arrogantly, didn't she? On her own terms, trusting in her own wisdom, and it almost cost her her life. Now, there's another scene a little bit later in the movie, and it's in the same throne room, and again, the king is on his throne, and he's having this meeting with some other dignitaries. All these people in here are bowing down, head to the ground, and the doors in the back of the room fly open, and this little girl starts running down the aisle. She does not slow down. She does not bow. There is no observance of protocol. She gets closer and closer. The guards do not draw their swords this time. Amazingly, she starts running up the steps. She's getting way too close to the king. But she gets even closer. She touches him. And then she crawls up on his lap, and then she whispers in his ear. She speaks to the king before he spoke to her. It's a total breach of protocol. But it doesn't matter. Because you know who she is. You know that this is his daughter. And protocol doesn't matter. She can approach the throne confidently because she belongs to him, right? It's not arrogance. She's the daughter of the king. It's confidence. It's the boldness of a child with their father. The only reason, and here's what I want you to hear from this passage in Hebrews, the only reason we can approach the throne of God with confidence is that we are joined to his son. The Son of God grabs our hand and says, come with me. And he runs down the aisle and he says, you can be in here too because you're with me. Here's what's even better. When we put our faith in Jesus, he makes us his brothers and his sisters, so we're children of God too. So we can actually with confidence run up to the throne and whisper to God what's going on in our life and hear from him with that kind of confidence. So let me ask you, what are you trusting in? Really, to give you access to God? Are you deep down trusting in your record of good works and how good you're doing in your spiritual life, your morality, your religion, your intellect, your spirituality, your philosophy of life? This text is saying us today that the only reason we can have confidence to have access to God is that we have a great high priest. We don't trust in our own abilities, we trust in his ability. We don't trust in our own righteousness. We trust in his righteousness, his record, right? We don't trust in our sacrifices. We trust in his sacrifice. Jesus is the better high priest, so he gives us better, confident, bold access. Let's thank him.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.